film that shows the use of toxic pesticides are having far-reaching impacts on a wide range of environments, including beehives. Again, that's a film screening at the documentary Keep the Hives Alive, Thursday, August 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at thekbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM, the Pacifica Network, and online at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Lisa Forestell. Lisa is the Director of Community Development at the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community. Lisa is a voice hearer and an activist and psychiatric survivor, and she's a group facilitator and trainer of Hearing Voices groups and Alternatives to Suicide groups. So welcome to Madness Radio, Lisa Forestell.
Thanks for having me, Will.
Lisa, I know you're very involved with the Hearing Voices movement in the U.S. and internationally. I just want to congratulate you on all the work that's being done with the Hearing Voices Congress, which is coming up soon in Boston.
Thanks a lot. We're getting really, really beyond excited about it. It's been 2 years in the making at this point. And I thought I was excited when we took the project on, and I just get a little more so every day. So we're really looking forward to welcoming the international crowd to U.S. shores for the first time.
Yeah, the Hearing Voices movement is a whole international effort to change the way that psychiatry and society respond to these experiences. We're going to be talking about the organizing and the work of the Hearing Voices movement on the show. And I just want to start out by asking you about your own experiences. How did you first realize that you were a voice hearer? How did you get involved in the psychiatric system? And what was it that led you to go on to become an activist and advocate and trainer?
Oh, boy. That is a huge question. The first part is I've always been a voice hearer, but I didn't realize I was a voice hearer. So I've heard voices for as long as I have memory, and I think at that time I thought everybody had voices similar to mine. So I didn't think anything of it at all until I started interacting with folks with bodies that found my friendships with my voices unsettling. So that happened in elementary school, you know, as I started to get into school. So my family was fairly receptive, or thought that I had little friends or whatever, you know, however they explained it. But I started getting pushback from folks outside of our family when I went to school.
So it wasn't really a problem when you first had it, and when you were a kid. It was really when you got out into the larger society. Your family was very accepting, and just, this was okay. This is normal. This is considered just fine.
Yeah, I was actually overseas. My father had been stationed overseas. My entire family was over there, really during a developmental phase in my life. I was, you know, a toddler, acquiring language and friendships, but my friendships were with my voices. And so it was kind of lonely there because everybody else spoke Thai. So when I came back to the States, it was really reinforced that my relationship with my voices was not okay, that it was going to interfere with my education. I really got teased by the other kids, and so it was really a harsh reckoning.
Well, help us to understand what it is that you're experiencing. So you're a kid and you're having like imaginary friends that you hear and then you speak to and then you hear them talk back to you? Or how is your voice hearing experience?
Well, I've never really considered them imaginary. I've just accepted them as a part of my experience. And so I don't, even now, I don't necessarily have the words to really truly describe them. I usually use the word companion because I think other folks get that. But I have three voices predominantly. I also have visual and tactile things that happen for me, which are also kind of within the hearing voices realm that other people don't experience. And sometimes I just kind of have an entire either out-of-body experience or extrasensory experience that other folks don't share. But my primary day-to-day experience, they are here with me right now, are my three companions.
Are they? Can we welcome them on the show? Are they listening in? Are they talking to you now?
They are definitely listening in. They tend to be quiet while I'm talking to other folks. And as I tell my story, I think you'll understand why that is. But they're definitely listening and actually tittered a little bit at being welcomed. So thanks very much.
Oh, well, maybe we can hear more from them later on in the show. And I guess this really underscores that there's really a huge diversity to both what people experience as voice hearing and also the language that they use. Tell us more about what that is for you and who are these three companions?
I'm going to flash forward real quick because I really want to offer this story. I was doing a training, a hearing voices training, and I offered my testimony about what my experience is personally. And somebody came up to me afterwards and said, you are so lucky to know your three spirits. And this person had a belief system whereby all of us are assigned and have three spirits that walk through life with us. And she was just joyous that I knew mine so well. I so appreciated that framework because the idea that my companions are on this journey with me is very much how I believe what's going on for me. And I'd never, ever thought of them as spirits because I really do think of them very much like I do my corporeal friends. So it was a really cool story to hear. And every once in a while, one of my voices will say something in just such a way that it feels very much like a predestined partnership that the four of us are on.
So these are very supportive companions. These are like friends. These are helpers. These are really sort of part of your family in a sense.
They are. And just like family, we get into rows and, you know, have it out every once in a while. But for the most part, they're some of my most trusted souls. They're very important to me.
Can you give us an example of the kinds of things that they say or how your interactions are?
Voice hearers, like you said, have just a myriad of different experiences, and some folks will hear voices from parts of their body and inside of their body, and other folks will hear them from outside of their body. And then just very, very different, you know, one single voice can have many different voices or different ways to offer themselves. My voices, I hear exclusively from outside of my body. It can be from different distances. It is through my ears. And they tend to hover. Again, that spiritual illusion really, really held a lot of sway for me because I don't usually visualize my voices as standing on the ground. They're hovering and they're with me. One is male and two are female. When we were little, we were all the same age. The male decided to grow up with me, so he's in his 50s like I am, and the girls decided to stay young, and so they help me hold my childlike curiosity. They play with me. I don't know, staying in touch with a bit of the vitality that's hard to stay in touch with as you grow older. And my male voice keeps it real. He keeps it 100. He does so in some crass ways sometimes, but when we found out about the Hearing Voices movement, we had closeted our experience for 40 years, I think. We stayed that way. So although I had interaction with the mental health system, I suffered a rape in college and was diagnosed because that was actually traumatic and I had a response to it. I became a mental health patient for, you know, the next 30 years or so as a result of that. But I never reported to them my voice hearing. It is in my charts when I was in the hospital. I think it was observed by a couple folks, but I never said that it was something that I experienced or something that I wanted help around. And when I was on a medication that muffled my voices, I would talk myself off of that medication or stop taking it so I could hear my voices.
What's your belief about why you have these companions and maybe other people don't? And a kind of like a psychologist might say, oh, these are parts of yourself that are split off and they're separate and they're actually inside of your head, but you're imagining that they're companions and you're imagining that they're outside. They're not really real. They're just sort of parts of yourself. That would be maybe a conventional perspective. But what's your perspective on why you have these experiences and what they're about?
I actually know quite a few people that do feel that explains their voice hearing. For me, that works up into a point. I do think that a lot of the ways that I walk through my world are very much influenced by the trauma that I've experienced and the learning that I've had along my journey. But because these voices have been with me for as long as I can remember, quite frankly, prior to my first memories of trauma, like my first memory of trauma, it's really weird because it's another sexual abuse memory, and it was when I was probably 3 years old, and we were in Thailand, and the voices are already there, and I have a very distinct memory that they were already there. And they were already supportive. And although I have a memory of a very awful thing that happened to me, my voices were already there.
That is something that the Hearing Voices movement has suggested. And I think it maybe is true for a lot of people that the trauma happens and then the voices come as a response to the trauma. And you're saying that actually for you, that's not so much an explanation that fits.
Maybe I'm just more open to hearing things or seeing things that others don't. So there's you know, theory around that too, that there's different accesses in our brain that people have available to them that some other folks don't, or whatever that is. I definitely identify pretty strongly with the idea of a trauma model, with the exception of my voices being a part of me. I don't think they are. They're separate souls that are on a journey with me.
So coming back to the story, you have to go into the closet at an early age with your companions. You go through school, and then this terrible tragedy happens with the rape, and you said that really brought you into the psychiatric system. But you, at that time, you also kept hidden from the psychiatric system these experiences of your companions. So what happened to you when you started to be part of mental health treatment?
I was given an antidepressant that I think actually kind of triggered like a mania of sorts. So I started to get a heaped on pile of diagnoses that really should have, I don't know, I think I should have had some sort of episodic interaction with the mental health system as they supported me through the trauma of physical violence that I'd undergone. But instead I got pulled into the system. I was convinced that I needed to realign my goals and my expectations of what my life could be. And I was really off balance. You know, the world had treated me in some pretty harsh ways, and I really was, I really believed that the mental health system knew what they were doing and that they could help me.
So you sort of internalized the diagnosis. You started to see yourself as the way you were labeled.
I did. I mean, it all made sense. I struggled coming out of the last years of college because college had been pretty hard on me. And so when a psychiatrist said, you need to realign your goals, I was like, well, that makes sense. I struggled so hard. I, I must not be able to do this. And I think even at that, the initial diagnosis was a relief for me because I didn't know what was going on for me. And it was good to have somebody telling me. And I don't think I realized that it was also incredibly limiting and really, really harming. So, yeah. And there was enough going on in the rest of my world that I needed to just be able to rely on something because the rest of the world wasn't making very much sense.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest today is Lisa Forestell. Lisa is the Director of Community Development at the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community. She's a voice hearer, an activist, and psychiatric survivor, and she's the group facilitator for Hearing Voices groups and Alternatives to Suicide groups. How did you get out of that framework of seeing yourself through the diagnostic lens? And what role did your companions play in that process?
I think we were all trying to figure it out. But I pretty much ran the gambit of being a professional mental health patient. I wanted to find the right pill. I wanted to, find the right protocol or training or some way to fix me. I was very, very focused and very compliant around being fixed. And you can only do that for so many years before you realize that the folks trying to fix you really don't know much more than you do, and that the interventions they're using are harmful. So I was 80 pounds heavier than I needed to be and really stuck in my bedroom. I couldn't really leave my bedroom. And I was living such a limited existence that really my only ongoing conversation, and it very much involved my voices, was around my own death and wondering whether or not they would go on if I didn't.
You were wondering if your companions would continue and be okay if you died in exactly the same way that someone might worry about if their family or their friends would be okay if they, or their pets if they died.
And that's exactly what my conversation was, because I was most concerned about my children and my voices. How would they be if I stopped existing?
They became a reason to live, it sounds like.
Yeah, although my male voice honestly was willing to be very philosophical about it, and he is to this day. Like, we have really interesting conversations around kind of the existentialism of life and death. And so that was his preferred conversation. You know, he liked to really get involved in that. But the girls were terrified at the thought of my not being around any longer. And it was so helpful to hear from them, because I couldn't actually entertain this with my children. You know, I couldn't talk about it with them. So hearing from my girls, from that visceral place where I might be identified in kind of a maternal way sometimes, was really important to hear from. And they helped me to figure out that it wasn't necessarily death that I was talking about. It was circumstance, and that was what needed to change. So I ended my marriage, which was also many years. You know, that's a great big old kettle of fish right there. But moving out of that house that had really trapped me, along with all these other identities that had been forced on me over the years, was a great big turning point for me. My voices came with me. They didn't have to pack much. And eventually my two youngest children came with me too. And now, you know, the kids are all grown and I'm still on the planet. And that just kept me moving away from the mental health system. It was a slow movement away. I know a lot of folks in the world that I wander through now that are truly non-compliant, and at different times have just said no, and variations of that, sometimes much more flowery. And I don't feel like I ever did that. Sometimes I wonder what would have happened if I had. But it's been reflected back to me that I was non-compliant, that I was not willing to keep doing the same old thing and not expect a different outcome. And I was almost entirely off the psychotropic medication before I made the final cut with psychiatry and the mental health world, with their knowledge, but with my insistence. And I was using human rights policies and things to make sure that I had some autonomy around it.
Was it just because the medications weren't working and it wasn't helpful to you and the side effects, or what was it that led you to get off of the psychotropics?
I think that's primarily what it is. I had gained a vast amount of weight, and that affected how I could be in my world. I'm an avid alpine skier, which is really hard to do when you're really heavy, and that's coming from somebody who skied through her pregnancies and everything else. And so it was really nice to get back in shape, and that helped a lot just coming off the medications.
And Lisa, was your first contact with the Hearing Voices movement, was it through the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community?
It was, and I'm so thankful that they committed their resources to providing the group that I started attending, to providing the training that helped me become a facilitator, to providing this avenue by which I've really, and my male voice, have really found a passion and kind of a faded existence. So that was just hugely important, and it's part of this long piece that my voice has around changing the world. So,
Lisa, one of the things that you do now is you facilitate Hearing Voices groups, and you're a trainer in Hearing Voices groups and a big part of the Hearing Voices movement. Tell us something about the kinds of ways that people learn to live with their voices, the kinds of things that you're working with people in the groups, how the groups are helpful to people, and sort of how they work for people who don't know about the Hearing Voices movement.
Yeah, so Hearing Voices groups are very much like how I wish school was, where people would be curious about each other's experience and who they are and how they form their opinions of the world. And that's what Hearing Voices groups are. And they become these sacred spaces where we can talk about things that really we don't have permission to talk about anywhere else in our lives. I should say that my voices and I were really, really pessimistic about the Hearing Voices movement, and I watched it for a couple years before I started to interact with it, and then felt like I was kicking the tires of a used vehicle, like I really didn't trust it, and that my male voice, when we decided to come out during that conversation, he actually said, "It's my fate that we do Hearing Voices work. This is why I'm here." So I think, you know, it's kind of a packed deal and we're all in it, but he particular in and of himself feels as though he's fated to be a part of the Hearing Voices movement and be a part of bringing Hearing Voices to the U.S. So that happened, back in 2008 or 9 or so. And since then, I've pretty much been just really eager to learn as much as I can about the Hearing Voices movement, to be a part of the Hearing Voices USA network here in the U.S. and part of Intervoice internationally, and then just being a part of these beautiful sacred spaces where we talk about what works and what doesn't work and why. We talk with each other's voices. We talk about different steps that we've taken in relationship building with our voices. We have fun little tactics that give us a break, not only from our voices, but oftentimes from other relationships that we have in our lives. I've been a part of the movement long enough that technology has been a huge part of those tactics. So when I was first a member of Hearing Voices groups, we would share, you know, you should get one of those Bluetooth things and put it in your ear, and then you can say anything you want and everybody will think you're on the phone. But now it's almost as though if you're quiet, people think you're odd because everybody's talking to somebody that's not there, because the technology has, you know, eclipsed. And so now in groups, we don't talk about that so much, because there's actually a strange element of technology that has made voice hearers that talk out loud to their voices more comfortable in some situations than they would have been otherwise. I tend, in my communications with my voices, I'm more animated than I am when I talk with other people. And so I have to check that. And so that's been my experience when I'm talking with other folks too, is that we have to tone it down. But otherwise, we can, throwing air quotes, we can get away with a lot more than we used to be able to. And little by little, and this does my heart good, is more and more people in the United States know about the Hearing Voices movement and at least have an inkling or a curiosity around the experience being something other than a mental health illness or connected with some sort of disease or disorder process. So it is pretty easy for me now to start a conversation, and somebody will quickly want to ally themselves with me, and they'll say, oh yeah, I heard my mom calling my name 3 weeks after she passed, rather than saying, you're one of those folks and, you know, do you see a psychiatrist? So that conversation has been changing. But really, the groups are amazing because even if we're not talking about voice hearing in particular, the camaraderie that is developed and being able to leave that space and still know that you're not alone in the world, that there are other people that have similar experiences that are so unique that you can't wait to get back to that group and find out more about that person is kind of life-giving in a way that I didn't expect.
How would you respond to someone who isn't sure if they're a voice hearer, who maybe has a similar but different kind of experience to the things that we've been talking about?
I guess I would respond with, that's entirely up to you. I think self-defining one's experience is really, really part and parcel to the Hearing Voices movement. I would also say that if you're not really sure, you should sit with yourself and do some self-exploration around that, because it will be you that kind of determines whether or not you're a voice hearer. Most voice hearers are pretty sure that they are. But I know a lot of people that don't identify as voice hearers, but have ongoing dialogue with what they consider their inner voices, and they find Hearing Voices groups really supportive environments to figure out what that is for them and how to be more supportive of themselves and compassionate about their own journeys. So I'm not sure when it all comes out in the wash that identifying yourself as a voice hearer is as important as it is being an active participant in your own journey.
Lisa, we are just about out of time. So give us information about how people can get in touch with you, and also how they can find out more about the Hearing Voices movement in general, and also about the 2017 Hearing Voices Congress in Boston.
Sure. The best email address to find me at will be with the Western Mass RLC. You can find me at lisa@westernmassrlc.org. And to find out more about the Hearing Voices USA, we are at hearingvoicesusa.org. There's great resources there, calendar of events, group locator mechanism, so you can find out if there's groups hanging out near you. And all the latest news that is happening in the U.S. and internationally is somehow linked at that address.
Lisa Forestell, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Lisa Forestell. She's Director of Community Development at the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community. Lisa is a voice hearer. She's a Hearing Voices Group facilitator and trainer, and also a facilitator and trainer of the Alternatives to Suicide Groups. And she's an activist and psychiatric survivor. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall, and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503 231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, I'm Ed Melnick. In solidarity with San Francisco's 50-year anniversary of the Summer of Love, I'm inviting you to join me for a 2-hour special Monday sampler on August 7th.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on Trampoline.
From the 1967 music scene, music from artists like Janis Joplin, the Jefferson Airplane, the Beatles, and many others will be featured. Join me for 2 hours to tune in, turn on, and drop out. That's Monday, August 7th, 2 to 4 p.m.
If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair.
KBOO Portland.
And now the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, August 7th, 2017. In local news, last week the Portland City Council voted unanimously to spend up to $500 million to construct a water filtration plant to treat Portland's water supply. The council was forced to act after cryptosporidium was found in the Bull Run water that makes up the vast majority of Portland's water supply. Cryptosporidium, usually called crypto, is a microscopic parasite found in animal feces. Numerous tests from Portland's Bull Run water supply this year were found to be positive for the crypto parasite. The positive tests violated federal EPA drinking water standards, forcing the council to act. The council also considered building an ultraviolet system that would have only cost $100 million, but opted for the expensive filtration system since it would also remove other contaminants. The new water filtration system is expected to raise the average consumer's bill by up to $18 per month. The city council will spend the next 60 days developing a plan for the construction of the plant. It is expected to take up to 10 years to build. In national news, as the Trump administration falls further into chaos, President Trump has increasingly turned to military officers to help run his administration.